The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Croner from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall bring you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Well, welcome back. If you caught us last week, you heard about our talk about the North Carolina Museum of Art. I hope you got some valuable information from that, and you'll soon come to pay a visit because it really is worth your time. Okay, let's go back to the wonderful old Reader's Digest where we were before. And we're going to read something that's, I'm kind of turning a page here, so forgive me. It's A Mad, 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 Mad World, which was something we did 2 weeks ago. And we didn't get to finish them all. So let's go to the videotape. Karen McBride first learned she was a wanted woman after she got married. When she filed the paperwork to change her name on her driver's license, she was told that she had been flagged by the computer and needed to call the district attorney's office in Cleveland County, Oklahoma. They informed her of the charge against her, felony embezzlement. "I thought I was going to have a heart attack," she told Fox 25. She asked what exactly she was accused of. She had never swiped money from a bank, misused escrow funds, or committed any of the other financial high crimes that usually result in embezzlement charges. In fact, she was told the accusation against her was far more singular: renting a VHS tape of Sabrina the Teenage Witch 21 years earlier and failing to return it. But Bragg, 52, swears this isn't true. She wasn't watching Sabrina when she was in her 30s. She insists, and she certainly would have held onto the tape all these years. Fortunately for McBride, the store that owned the tape went out of business in 2008. The DA dropped the charges. Polly needs her mouth washed out. Last September, five African gray parrots, Billy, Eric, Tyson, Jade, and Elsie, had to be separated for encouraging each other to swear at patrons at the Lincolnshire Wildlife Center in the United Kingdom. We are quite used to parrots swearing, but we've never had five at the same time, and for the some reason, these five relish it, Steve Nichols, the Jew's chief executive, told the Associated Press. People were mainly entertained by the pouty-mouthed parrots. When a parrot tells you to F off, it amuses people very highly. It's brought a big smile to a really hard year, he said. But for the sake of children, the zoo decided it was better to put the birds in separate enclosures until they can learn to behave. Talk about a snow job. Ukrainian police received an emergency phone call from a man who said he'd just stabbed his mother's partner. The victim, the caller said, was showing no signs of life and the police should hurry. Oh, and bring a snowplow because with all the snow it wasn't possible to reach his house otherwise. Police arrived shortly after and discovered not only that the alleged victim was safe and sound, but also that he had never been attacked. The call was a ruse by the man to have the road in front of his home plowed for free. I wonder what he had to pay for that one. Reunited, this is Everyday Miracles section. Reunited with her rescuers. 35 years after two fishermen plucked a young girl from the Pacific Ocean, a podcast leads to a remarkable reunion. And there's a picture of the young girl being rescued by a swimmer in 1986. Desiree Rodriguez, 9, floated in her life jacket until help arrived. And then there's a meeting in 2021. Kept afloat by her orange life jacket, 9-year-old Desiree Rodriguez had watched helplessly as one family after another let go of life. Just as she, too, began to give up, the skipper of a fishing boat spotted her bobbing in the water. Within minutes, the boat's first officer leaped in and grabbed Desiree, pulling her back toward the boat and toward life. That was 35 years ago, and the last time the rescuers and the girl saw one another until this year. May 18, 1986, was a kind of beautiful sunny day that regularly brought the Rodriguez family to California's Catalina Island for some fishing on their 28-foot pleasure boat, the DC-2. Desiree's father, a 30-year-old construction worker named Thomas Rodriguez, loved the sport, especially catching bass. A strong, slender man, he had instilled in his oldest daughter a love of the outdoors, teaching her how to bait a hook and cast a line. As was their custom at least once a month, the family boarded their boat that morning for a carefree day trip. For the first time, Thomas's sister, Corrine Wheeler, 33, and her husband, Alan Wheeler, 34, had decided to join them, leaving their three children at home in the Riverside, California neighborhood where both families lived. They spent the day fishing in the Pacific Ocean, then left the island in the early evening. Soon dense fog rolled in. Desiree fell into a light sleep beside her 5-year-old sister, Tricia, at a table on the boat's lower deck. Their father's sharp order startled her awake. "Get out of the boat! The boat's sinking. Get out of the boat." Desiree pushed her sister into the cold, dark water. Both girls wore life jackets. The adults did not. The girls were followed by their mother, Petra Rodriguez, a petite, quiet 29-year-old who was pregnant. Within seconds, the boat capsized, leaving just the tip of its bow in the air. and the six family members stranded. Looking in the face of her father, mother, aunt, and uncle, and sister, Desiree wasn't frightened. It was like what you would see in a movie, she recalls. You could see nothing around you. It was just dark, but it was peaceful, quiet. After some time, her father told them he would swim for help. I'll be back, he said, before disappearing into the darkness. My dad was like the superhero to me. I actually thought he would get help, Desiree said. After some time, her mother began foaming at the mouth, and then she went still. Desiree wrapped a rope around her mother's chest and tied her to the boat so she wouldn't float away. Then her sister died, too. I remember it was pretty much quiet after that, Desiree says. I think we were all just kind of in disbelief and just waiting. Paul Strasser and Mark Pisano, two strapping 23-year-olds, were still new to captaining ships when they pushed off from San Pedro at 6 on the morning of May 19th. They had 35 passengers aboard the First String, a boat they'd helped build for a fishing expedition. The best friends had met at 14-year-olds. Soon after, Strasser had quit his job delivering newspapers to join Pisano, working on fishing boats, where they scrubbed decks, cleaned fish, and earned the title of pinheads, eager young fishermen learning the ropes. They graduated to deckhands and eventually to full-fledged fishermen. They spent their free time learning their trade. Before long, they became two of the youngest captains in San Pedro's 22 Street Landing. Their fishing trip that day began uneventfully. Pisano remembers the weather was pea soup fog, so thick you couldn't see the stern of the boat, and the fish weren't biting all morning. We were going to try one more spot, then go home, Pisano says. But then some yellowtail, a prized game fish, started biting. The fishermen hung around for another couple of hours, pulling in fish after fish. As they worked, the fog cleared and the sun started shining. As the night turned into the next day, Desiree and her aunt and uncle were slipping in and out of consciousness. To keep themselves awake, Desiree and her aunt daydreamed about what they would do after they were rescued. They would stay in a hotel, order room service, and burrow under the blankets in bed, cozy and warm. We still had hope, Desiree said. Like we're going to be okay, we're going to come out of this. Her uncle evidently didn't share their hope. With the afternoon sun now high overhead, she recalls, he swam away from the boat. He just kind of gave up, she recalls. She swam after him, propelled by her aunt's plea. Don't let him drown. Desiree caught up with him quickly, but struggled to keep her tall, stocky uncle above water. She finally had to let go, and he slipped beneath the surface. Desiree doesn't remember how or when her aunt died, but soon the 9-year-old became aware that she was alone in the ocean. At that point, I just kind of made the decision. I need to get away from this boat, Desiree remembers. I need to swim away, somewhere else. Where? I don't know. Late that afternoon, Strasser and Pisano set off on a return voyage to San Pedro with their haul of fresh-caught yellowtail. About 7 miles away from Catalina, Strasser noticed something white flashing in the water. He steered the First String toward it and peered through his binoculars, thinking it might be a boat bumper. "We've got something going on here. This is weird," Strasser recalls saying. "When I pulled up to it, I saw a dead body face down. It was tangled up in all this rope." Strasser radioed the Coast Guard. Passengers were yelling on deck below. In the commotion, he noticed two other people in the water. One was floating face down. The other, wearing an orange life jacket, was bobbing into the swells, her head and brown hair visible just above the water. "I knew if it had a life jacket, and I saw a brown thing above it, we have a chance," Strasser said. He steered the boat closer, and Pisano jumped into the water. Pumping with adrenaline, he swam toward the figure and grabbed the life jacket. From a nearly unconscious state, Desiree flinched. Pisano swam her back to the boat, where Coast Guard medics covered her in warm water bottles that felt prickly on her cold skin. "If the boat hadn't come right then," says Desiree, now 45, "I don't think I would have lived. I'll be honest with you. I think at that point I was just kind of done." A Coast Guard spokeswoman said at the time that Desiree had a strong, resilient constitution. The little girl walked out of the hospital the next day after being treated for exhaustion and hypothermia. When officials finally pulled the family's boat out of the water, they didn't find any sign of a collision, concluding that a large swell, perhaps in the wake of a passing ship, may have capsized the DC-2. The two bodies they had found were Desiree's mother and aunt. The search for Desiree's father, sister, and uncle was abandoned 2 days after her rescue. "I had even hoped that my dad did make it somewhere," Desiree said. Maybe he is living on an island and just got amnesia and didn't know he has a family. You know, you always have hope. But you get older and reality sets in and you're like, okay, he didn't make it. Desiree Rodriguez, now Desiree Campuzano, was adopted by another aunt and uncle. No one asked about her experience in the water. They didn't want to traumatize her, she says. She attended therapy for a while, but mostly she coped by herself and tried to be a good person, guided constantly by the question, what will my parents expect of me? Desiree attended junior college while building a career in criminal justice. She married in 2013 and had a son 6 years ago. In her late 20s, Desiree began to wonder about her rescuers. She sent Oprah Winfrey a message to try to get help finding them, but nothing came out of it. Strasser and Pisano sometimes thought of her too, especially when anyone asked, what's your craziest story at sea? But neither Desiree nor the man who saved her knew where to start looking. Desiree was a ghost, Strasser says. We saved her, she's out in the world, and that's all we knew. When the COVID-19 pandemic derailed Philip Friedman's plans to return to his teaching job near Shanghai, China, the 63-year-old fishing off a Kanada, the 53-year-old fishing freak decided to stick around Southern California with his family and make a podcast about his hobby. Friedman Adventures, lost in December 2020, broadcasting stories from fishermen around the wharf talking about boats, catches, and fishing trips. One episode featured Pisano talking about the 1986 rescue. That day, 41-year-old Pablo Pena turned in on the show in his 20-minute commute to work as a railroad engineer. The incredible story he heard in the air triggered a memory. Pena remembered a conversation he'd had with years earlier with a former co-worker. She made an offhand comment about losing her parents in a boating accident and being the only survivor. It started to churn my wheels, and I was like, well, it could be her, Pena said, but he would have to say her name was Desiree Rodriguez to make this solid. Then Pisano said on the podcast, her name was Desiree Rodriguez, the girl we rescued. There's like, I can't tell you how many Desiree Rodriguez's in L.A. I was like, holy moly, Pena said. Wow, this is just surreal. He had met the podcaster a decade early on a fisher excursion, so he sent a message to Friedman. I was like, you gotta be kidding me, dude, Friedman says. My brain was like, I'm going to try to locate her. We've got to finish this story. Friedman concocted a plan to surprise the two fishing captains with the woman they'd rescued years earlier. First, he reached out to Desiree to assure she wanted to meet her rescuers. I was just like, this is weird. Not a bad word. It's just kind of eerie. Now, says Desiree, now a sergeant in the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. After all these years, for this to come up, what are the chances? Very slim. Desiree agreed to show up at the studio a few days later. The plan was that she would pose as Raquel, a translator, who was going to retell the captain's rescue tale on Spanish television. I was nervous at first, Desiree said, just seeing the guys and putting the kind of finalization to what happened. All smiles, she listened to her rescuers recount their side of the story, clueless to her true identity. After almost 10 minutes, Friedman ended the ruse. Boys, I want to tell you something. This is not a translator. I'm going to let her introduce herself to you. I'm Desiree, she said, her voice wavering. Pisano slapped the table in an instant of recognition. Amid hugs, tears, and exclamation, the story to kids early had united the strangers came tumbling out. I feel like the short of our daughter in a way, because we brought her back to life, Strasser says. For years, Desiree had wondered about the men who rescued her. Now that she's met them, she says she hopes to stay connected forever. On May 18, 2021, the 35th anniversary of the accident, Strasser and Pisano took Desiree and her family on their fishing boat to Catalina Island, following the same course they took all those years ago. It looked just the same as it did the day we found her, says Strasser. They stopped the boat, and the family said some prayers. Then the man handed them bunches of flowers, carnations, roses, and lilies, to toss into the water in remembrance. It was an almost uncannily perfect gesture. The men had no way of knowing, so a teary Desiree explained. Her mother had loved lilies, her favorite flower. And there's pictures of them hugging right beside their boat. And there's another picture of them, of her standing with them, and there's a picture of the two guys as young men in their 20s with a big fish, and there's her standing between the two of them, and they really kind of look like they did almost 35 years ago. They're a little heavier, and their hair is a little different, but their faces are the same, and Desiree, of course, looks a lot different than a 9-year-old. Now the health section. My autism diagnosis at age 46. I had always felt different. When I finally learned why, I felt relieved, happy, and at last, whole. By Wanda Deschamps. I'm 10 years old, away at my first sleepover camp. The rest of the girls in my cabin are trying to put together a skit for the camp's variety show, and I can see that it isn't going to come together the way they imagine. I have a sixth sense about these things, as if I'm on the outside looking in when I'm supposed to be part of something. I want to speak up and tell them how to fix it, but I've learned that being in the know-it-all does not make me popular. There is something about me that most people consider different. I don't enjoy sitcoms or skip rope the way other girls my age do. I'm not comfortable hugging friends, but I do love listening to discussions about politics. I'm very talkative and inquisitive, which seems to wear out the patience of my friends and sometimes even the adults around me. My fourth grade report card outlined my social deficiencies. With needs improvement, I stick out from my classmates, but I'm learning to be less conspicuous. I feel lonely, but lonely is better than ridiculed. It wasn't until decades later that I learned my uniqueness has a name, autism. My diagnosis at 46 was like discovering a piece of my brain, picking it up and putting it in place, and feeling whole for the first time. What I found out since is that there are a significant number of others like me, individuals who aren't identified as having autism until midlife. A neurodevelopmental condition, autism can cause communication differences and a lack of awareness of social cues. For many who have it, social interactions have to be learned as opposed to intuited. I can appear dispassionate even though I am empathetic. I am highly loyal, honest, straightforward, and direct. I'm driven by intellectual inquiry and thus more interested in why something happened than how it happened. I'm capable of stunning people by reciting credit card numbers from memory, and I sometimes speak quickly and with a sense of conviction because I have moved along a conversation in my mind while the other person is still formulating his or her next thought. At work, I have been both highly praised for these attributes and harshly admonished. Initially, I was not great at camouflaging my condition. It could be finessed only with frequent practice. So I focused on other strategies to combat my differences. In school, I paid attention to the interests and behaviors of the most popular girls, adopting their attitudes and ways of communicating. I was involved in a wide range of activity, from dancers to figure skating to acting to chorus singing, and I kept a to-do list to ensure everything was managed. It was almost as if every minute of the day was planned and structured, so I could focus more on what I was doing and less on how I was doing, and even less how I felt I was doing. Eventually, I learned to feel a sense of belonging, and while social acceptance offered a reprieve from feeling as though I was living on the margins, it also delayed my diagnosis. In my 20s, I found work at a university fundraising program and got married. It was good at my job. It provided an avenue for me to apply my attentive to detail. But my confidence took a severe hit when only 17 months after my wedding, my husband Stephen announced he was leaving me. Our lack of compatibility had not been obvious to me. I had convinced myself we belonged together because we were together rather than questions whether we were truly happy. It was my two young sons from my second marriage who helped unlock my hidden truth. Adrian read at age 3, wrote at age 4, and had astounding recall. Yet he struggled socially beginning in elementary school. His teachers noticed immediately that he avoided making eye contact, often preferred to be alone, and interested in topics well beyond his age level. Finally, in 2012, when he was 9, he was diagnosed with autism. Then, the next year, his brother Rene began to have challenges focusing, processing information, and interacting with first-grade classmates. Regrettably, because Adrian and Rene were very different from each other, autism didn't occur to us. By that time, my career was flourishing, but as I pushed higher at work, camouflaging my own condition left me fatigued, angry, and resentful. To combat my struggle to attach words to concept, I listened attentively to people I considered articulate and then memorized their words, phrases, and sentences and recorded them for future use. This presented as a commitment to self-improvement, but was really an intense focus, a hallmark of autism. When I became a full-time master's degree student, I also entered therapy for my growing anxiety. This was my third time in counseling, and the third time, I would dig deeper, feel better, and miss the most important component of the picture. Autism never entered the conversation. In 2015, I became a new job in which I was complimented and recognized as never before, and I didn't know how to deal with it. As I neared my one-year work anniversary, all the symptoms of my undiagnosed condition manifesting themselves in my work environment, sensory overload and being baffled by social cues and office politics. At home, Renee's symptoms were becoming more prevalent. We began the assessment process in early 2017. At the same time, my emotional troubles hit a crisis point, and in May I had a complete breakdown at work. The day after I received Renee's autism diagnosis, I asked my family physician to refer me for my own evaluation. "I think I have it too," I explained. My assessment consisted of completing an in-person exercises as well as adult autism spectrum quotient, a self-reporting survey of 50 statements, such as, "I would rather go to a library than a party. I am fascinated by numbers. I find it difficult to work out people's intentions." When, 2 months later, I received my diagnosis, I felt relief. Finally, everything started to make sense. I couldn't get over the positive effect of the diagnosis. Within months, I was asking myself, "This is life?" Today, I have an entrepreneur. My new firm is called Liberty Company to signify that confronting the facts brings us freedom. Our goal is to increase the population of neurodiverse people in the workplace. I have also become a champion for neurodiversity and gender equity by sharing my story and the stories of others, often under the banner of Inclusion Revolution, a worldwide movement launched by inclusivity leader Caroline Casey. Combining those two goals provides an avenue for me to be an advocate for women with autism, including as a participant in research into autistic women's experiences in the workplace. Self-awareness is the greatest gift you can give yourself. Knowing my strength as well as my limitations, both related and unrelated to my autism, has allowed me to build my self-esteem, connect with others. My family is the main beneficiary of all this positive change. Finally, I am a proud autism mom, modeling for my children how you can be unashamed, unafraid, and undeterred as an individual with unique abilities. To honor my newfound freedom, I refer to myself as the real Wanda. I like her. Don't call us, we'll call you. These hiring managers took Reddit to share their oddest job candidates they've interviewed. "What job interests you?" "What job do you mean?" "This job, the job you applied for." "What job is this again? What do you do here?" She listed all of her ex-boyfriends who currently work there and said she couldn't wait to see the looks on their faces when she showed up to work. "And what do you think you could bring to this role? Hire me and find out." We stopped the interview then and there. "See if you can decipher this applicant's so-called mission statement. Along with my detail-oriented organizational skills, I will bring encouraged team to work cooperative and creativity to provide an understanding of the visual aspects of our work." "I see you managed a vegetarian restaurant." "What?" "It says you managed a vegetarian restaurant." "Oh, I guess I did write that. Not really, though. My girlfriend had an art exhibition, and I organized the sandwiches for the opening. They were vegetarian." Now how about a drama in real life? Swarmed by killer bees, their toxins coursing through his bloodstream, a rock climber passes out on a ledge 130 feet up. Can his buddy reach him in time? 1,000 stings. The rock hills of Owaco Tanks rise dramatically above the scrubby Chihuahuan Desert in West Texas, 4 masses of weathered craggy rock that have long been a climbing paradise. Doug April was just finishing a 6-month stint as a Cast Hope camp host at Waco Tanks State Park, living by himself in an RV. The lanky 46-year-old was divorced with 3 kids, the youngest in junior high. He received 2 tours of duty in Iraq, where he saw plenty of that was hard to forget. Through it all, climbing had been a refuge. Out on the rock, he could turn off his buzzing mind and just focus on what was in front of him. Now, in May 2015, that respite was coming to an end. April had left the Army 3 weeks early, retiring as a major, but he wasn't through with war zones. In a few weeks, he was headed to Afghanistan for 3 months to fly reconnaissance missions as a private military contractor. He wanted to make the most of his last days of climbing. At around 8 a.m., April's climbing partner, Ian Capel, pulled up to the campsite. The 38-year-old geologist had moved to El Paso with his wife 5 years earlier. Burly and bearded, Capel met April while out climbing just after he'd moved to town, and they've been buddies ever since. Capel saw April as a kind of a big brother, an experienced climber and a generous teacher. "What should we do today?" April asked as they packed their ropes that morning. "Well, you've been up indecent exposure twice already," Capel said. "I'd like to do that route." April paused, looking down pensively at his red climbing shoes. Indecent exposure is always giving the heebie-jeebies. It wasn't the most difficult route in Owaco Tanks, but it was probably the most intimidating. He had 2 pitches, or sections between belay points, and both had passages that left you hanging out unprotected over a 130-foot drop. Midway along the route, there was a plaque in memory of a University of Texas El Paso student who had died while attempting it. But this would be April's last climb for quite a while, and he wanted to make it a memorable one. Capel agreed to lead the first part of the climb, and April would lead the second. Capel began working his way to his right, his chalk fingers holding their way to the cliff's handholds. He and April were tethered together for safety with two lines of rope, one blue, one orange, that connected them via belaying devices in each of their harnesses. These would act as brakes if either of them fell, holding the rope tight. Capel clipped the ropes into metal anchors drilled into the rock face as he went. For added protection, midway through the first pitch, just 20 minutes into the climb, he saw the memorial plaque for the UTEP student and silently paid his respects. He made it to the ledge that marked the end of the pitch and attached himself to an anchor. April followed, and they paused for a moment to rest, 130 feet up in the air. April led the second pitch. The hardest section came early on, a huge step to the right followed by 10 feet of slim fingertip and toe edges. He had trouble, though, in the past attempts, but this time he nailed it, making his way to a shelf the size of a refrigerator. "Oh, man, that was great," he called out across the chasm, about 10 feet above his partner and 25 feet out to the right. Then it spotted something he had not expected to see along the rocky face. "This is weird. Excuse me, the pages are stuck together." "All right," he thought. "Where did all these bugs come from?" April slapped the back of his neck. That was all the rest of the call he needed to hear. Suddenly, a cloud of bees swirled out of a nearby crack in the wall. More bees than he'd ever seen. It was like the scene from a horror movie. The swarm enveloped April in an instant, stinging him over and over again, the pain spreading across his neck, face, and body. Regular honeybees can sometimes be territorial, but Africanized bees, though somewhat smaller, are much more aggressive. They arrived in this hemisphere in 1956 when African bees introduced to Brazil to increase honey production escaped, bred with European honeybees, and ultimately spread across the Americas, making their way to the southwestern United States by the 1990s. When Africanized bees sense a threat, they don't just send a couple of bees to ward it off. They send hordes, and they'll keep chasing for the length of four football fields until the threat is eliminated. If someone stung 1,000 to 1,500 times, scientists estimate, you've got a 50-50 chance of dying. Since the 1950s, swarms of Africanized bees have been responsible for more than 1,000 deaths worldwide. Their reason, they're known as killer bees. Capel watched in disbelief as April jumped off the ledge. He felt the jerk of tension in his harness as his partner's weight pulled the rope taut. He had no idea what was wrong, nor why April urgently yelled, "Lower me, lower me, lower me, go, go, go." But from his perch on the narrow ledge, Capel pulled out all 200 feet of rope, ripping it through the belaying device as fast as he could. Below him, the wall sloped inward beneath the ledge he was standing on, and April disappeared from view. That's when Capel saw the first bee flying towards him. He figured it would go away if he just ignored it, and fled it through straight at him and stung him in the neck. The stings came quickly after that. 1, 2, 3, 4, then a crescendo of pain as the bulk of the hive attacked. Capel tried to cover his face, a high-pitched whine drowning out everything as the bees attacked his eyes, ears, nose, and mouth. His mind raced as the bees stung him. Why hadn't April unclipped himself once he reached the ground? Capel could have pulled up the rope, anchored himself to the wall, and rappelled down to safety. But April was still hanging there, dead wake. Capel stood on the ledge and sucked water out of his climbing bottle, desperate to stay hydrated in an effort to stave off the effects of the bee venom. He reached up to brush the bees off his head and felt a lever of insect bodies an inch thick, stinging him over and over again. The toxins coursed through his bloodstream. At a certain point, his thoughts turned from panic to a strange calmness. It was a terrible way to go. He was sorry his wife was going to lose him this way, but there was nothing he could do. The world shrank around him, contracting to a pinprick. And Capel blacked out, slumping down onto the rocky ledge. And there's a picture of the two climbers. Capel is definitely stocky and bearded, and the other guy is kind of slender and slightly receding hairline. And then there's a picture of the rock that climbed up and the ledge, and it really is a steep climb. It's almost straight up and down. Below him, April hung suspended in mirror, 6 feet away from the wall and about 65 feet off the ground. He'd been stuck that way for about 10 minutes, and the bees hadn't stopped singing. "Untie the blue rope," he yelled up to Capel. They were double rope for safety, and he wanted Capel to use one of the ropes to propel himself away from the insects. But neither man could hear the other. All they could hear was a deafening buzz. After so many stings, April's body was numb to the pain. He could feel the bees climbing all over him, but the stings hardly registered. One flew into his mouth, vibrating and fuzzy. with a slight flowery taste, and he quickly spat it out. After more than a dozen stings, people can experience vertigo, nausea, and even convulsions and fainting. April had been stung hundreds of times. He pulled his baseball cap over his face and tried to think. He'd always been able to keep his head in a bad situation. He'd crashed a helicopter in training and seen men die in combat. And no matter the danger, he'd always managed to flick a switch in his brain to turn off the fear and concentrate on what needed to be done. What needed to be done now was clear. He had to climb down. The face of the mountain was crisscrossed with climbing routes. He just had to find one. About 15 feet away, he potted an anchor that was part of another route. He swung himself toward the bolt and caught it on the third try, and clipped himself in. Then he released the rope that were attached to Capel, leaving them dangling in the wind. On a good day, this wouldn't have been that difficult a route, but this wasn't a good day. April was pumped full of bee venom, his body badly inflamed and his mind swimming. And yet through that fog of pain, toxins, and fear, he managed to carefully pick out the route. The climb down was the longest 5 minutes of April's life. By the time he made it to the ground, he was nauseous and nearly delirious. He stumbled toward the road just as a park ranger pulled up as part of his daily patrol. "Ian," April grasped, gasping up at the cliff. They could see Capel up on the ledge. He was in a fetal position, a massive cloud of bees surrounding him. "Ian," April yelled. His friend didn't move. The ranger called search and rescue, but April did the math in his head. It would take him about an hour to get a team from El Paso. To get a team that could safely climb up to Capel and remove him? That could take climbers who didn't know the area a few hours more. Capel likely didn't have that much time. April knew what he had to do. "Drive me back to my car," he said to the ranger. "I've got another rope in there. I'll go get him." April scrambled up the rocks as fast as he could in his condition. The quickest way to get Capel was to hike up the back of the mountain and rappel down to him. April wore the park ranger's radio as well as a mesh net that pulled over his cap. Partway up the trail, he ran into two climbing friends and conscripted them into the rescue plan. By the time they reached the top, it had been about 45 minutes since the start of the attack, and April had no idea whether Capel was still alive. Even his nausea state, it didn't cross his mind to ask one of his fellow climbers to head down instead. It was his partner down there. He would be the one to get him. April set an anchor at the edge of the cliff and clipped himself in. One of the other climbers began belaying him down. For about the first 50 feet, Capel was out of sight. Finally, the cliff grew steep enough that April could see his partner, still motionless, still covered by a swinging blanket of bees. "Ian," he yelled. This time, Capel looked up. He had the same look I've seen too many times in combat, where somebody's been blown up or shot, April remembers. It's not fear, exactly. More like a look of pure incredulity. "How did this happen to me?" That's how he looked at me. Then he put his head back down. April made his way down to the ledge. The bees were all over him again, too, but he barely noticed the new stings. He attached Capel to his belay device. "I'm going to get you out of here," he said. Capel was just conscious enough to follow April's simple instructions, while April carefully lowered him 130 feet to the ground. Below him, the first ambulance was just pulling up. April watched as the rangers and paramedics collected Capel. Then he lowered himself down. By the time he reached the down, Capel was on a helicopter destined for a hospital in El Paso. It was only then that the search and rescue team arrived in Hueco tanks. April turned down the paramedics' advice to go to the hospital, even though he felt faint. In the parking lot, he ran into two climbers who had wilderness first aid training. The best way to remove the stingers, they told him, was to use tweezers, which squeezes the poison from the venom sacs into your body. April stripped down to his boxers, and the two men used their credit cards to scrape him down, sloughing off hundreds of stingers that fell into the desert sand. At the hospital, doctors estimated that Capel had been stung more than 1,000 times, a high enough dose to be lethal. He was lucky. After a day or two, the venom was flushed out of his system, and he was fine. Months later, after April returned from Afghanistan, the men planned another climb. After all, it's what they did together. They climbed. And though they returned in Hueco tanks, they weren't ready to tackle indecent exposure again. "I made sure we weren't going to do that route," April said wryly. So up a different path they went. Any trepidation they might have felt out being out there dissipated quickly. They reached a small alcove high above the desert and sat down to rest. In the months since the attack, Capel had had plenty of time to think about what could have happened if April hadn't come back for him. His one memory after regaining consciousness is a thick carpet of dead bees covering the cliff ledge, and then April's red shoes entering the picture. Capel tried to tell April how much he appreciated what he'd done, how he'd come back for him even though himself had suffered so. But his friend waved him off. It hadn't even been a choice. There was just no way he was going to try to help me, says Capel. For From their perch on the small alcove, the men took in the view. Out there, in the basin and range province, just a little elevation gives sweeping vistas in every direction. The Franklin Mountains set out to the west, hazy and indistinct. To the north, 85 miles away, they could see the faint line of the Sacramento Mountains, silhouetted against a sky that seemed endless. The sun was just right, the breeze light. They stood up again, the rope strong and secure between them, and went back out on the rock. 4 myths about how we learn. I have a personal learning style, science. No such thing exists. You learn mostly by doing what you're trying to learn. 2, I should read that. I should reread that. Science, it doesn't work. Quizzing yourself about material does. 3, I'll trust my first answer. Science, humans are overconfident and shouldn't trust their quick response. 4, I need to spend 10,000 hours learning that. Science, that works for becoming an expert, but not for learning, which requires outside input. And with that, let's switch over to Consumer Reports. And 2 weeks ago, we were talking about the best new ways to work out at home. And we've done several things, including how to getting started. But however, let's go on with that and study what's right for you. Once you know the variables, consider which mix is the best fit. The options generally fall into 3 categories, each with pros and cons. If you're having trouble choosing, considering a test drive, many programs offer a free trial. If you crave variety, exercise apps or streaming workouts. Using one of these is like having a huge collection of workout videos. Some classes are streamed live at set times. Others are available on demand. You can access them with a phone, tablet, or smart TV app, or using your computer. Phone apps are portable, of course, so you can use them at a park or gym. Aptiv, for one, that's AAPTIV, for example, which specializes in audio workout, is $15 per month. Some of them, like Apple Fitness, $10 per month, and Obey Fitness, $27 per month, offer multiple types of classes, strength training, cardio, dance, yoga. Other like BARRE, that's BARRE, as in B-A-R-R-E, threes, ballet-inspired workouts, are $29 per month. Seven 7-minute workout, $10 a month, and silver sneakers for seniors, free with some Medicare Advantage plans, are narrow in focus. Most offer a variety of class lengths across all fitness levels. The downside, there's not much interactivity. You see the instructors live or recorded, but nobody actually sees you. So people who thrive on the energy of others, as in a live class, may find these lacking, and you won't get much feedback or progress tracking unless you have a fitness watch. Self-motivation is the key. For real-time feedback, live virtual training. The perks. If you're missing one-on-one trainers or live group classes but don't feel comfortable doing them in person, or you want the convenience of popping into a live session wherever you are, you can access a class or trainer through a web conference tool like Zoom. Even some gyms and studios that have returned to in-person instruction are still offering online versions. Another benefit of live virtual training is the real-time two-way connection. A personal trainer can see you and correct your form if necessary, for example, or an aerobics instructor can give you an inspirational shout-out. And there's a sense of community. You can see others working out during group classes, and they can see you. Online versions of live classes took off in 2020 out of necessity. For example, Lisa Kindler, a personal trainer and fitness instructor in Orange County, California, was working in Upstill Natural Change and doing one-on-one training when the pandemic hit. 2 days after the gym shut down, she taught her first online class. I just listened to the community, says Kendra, who taught several virtual classes a day during the height of the pandemic and still does it at night. The downside. These sessions tend to be run by independent instructors, not big fitness companies. So finding one that works for you may require word-of-mouth recommendations and trial and error. Also, this approach doesn't offer automatic stat tracking. A personal trainer can help monitor your progress, but with group classes, it's up to you. For the studio experience, consider a connected fitness system. The perks, if you're willing and able to pay top dollar, you can take Buzz, including studio cycling classes, or even stunning treks in your own home. The Peloton bike and Tordic Track Commercial 2550 treadmill are good examples of an exercise machine with an integrated touchscreen connected via the internet to classes and performance tracking, can transfer your cardio workouts. The magic ingredients here are live, interactive virtual group classes led by the sort of engaging instructors you'd find in front of a packed gym classes. This technology lets them engage with you directly while keeping an eye on your performance. Peloton offers a variety of classes for every level, time commitment, and musical taste. For $39 per month, plus the $1,895 cost of its basic bike, you get an all-access membership with real-time performance tracking and the ability to see how others in your class are doing. Members can give one another virtual high fives or schedule sessions with friends to work out together. And that's in parentheses. As with the $12.99 a month standalone Peloton app, which you can use without buying a Peloton bike, the all-access membership also includes entry to hundreds of non-bike classes. Some of these devices can make your workout more challenging. The iFit interactive technology, available with the Nordic Track treadmill and other types of equipment, will automatically adjust the incline speed or resistance to match an instructor's prompts or your virtual surroundings. The $2,500 high-end Peloton bike can also adjust resistance based on instructor cues. In the newest equipment subcategory, wall-mounted connected fitness system, the Mirror at $14.95 plus $39 per month fee, is a video screen shaped, as its name suggests, like a full-length mirror, in which a virtual trainer coaches you through fitness classes. Camera-enabled technology adapts the workout to your goals, and you can do one-on-one competitions with other users. Another wall-mounted system by Tonal, $29.95 plus $49 a month, has an interactive touchscreen and fold-out arms supporting digital weights, electronic-adjusted resistance cables, not heavy metal plates, for strength training. The downside, they're expensive. With big upfront equipment costs and sizable monthly fees, if you want something similar but for less money, see Build Your Own Peloton System, which we will look at in a little while. Okay, let's look at a couple of options here. Build Your Own Peloton System. Peloton is our top-rated exercise bike, but it costs $1,895 plus $39 a month for unlimited classes. Want the perks of a connected system at a smaller price? You can assemble something like the Peloton experience for less by comparing a conventional exercise bike with a reading shelf, a tablet or phone, and the workout app. Just know that without a true integrated system, you won't get detailed performance tracking or be able to compete with others on the leaderboard. And they have the real Peloton bike, and your first year cost will be a total of $2,363. The do-it-yourself Peloton bike, and you buy a $1,000 bike, which is not a Peloton, and use the monthly Peloton membership and an iPad mini for $400, your first cost is $1,556 for a year. And the budget Peloton, the bike is $500, finer form indoor exercise bike, your existing smartphone or tablet for a device. The app is the $12.99 monthly Peloton, cost you $656 for your first year. There's also the Schwinn IC4 at $900, the Perform Studio bike, Pro 289 at $1,600, and the Echelon X5S at $1,500. And MyFitness Face-Off, Apple versus Peloton. Apple recently launched its workout app, Fitness Plus, which is accessible only if you have an Apple Watch and iOS device. CR asked me to use my 2+ decades of experience evaluating and designing fitness programs to compare Apple Fitness to the Peloton app. You can get a great workout using either, but there are a few areas where one outshines the other. For a pro comparison, go to cr.org/ApplePeloton0921. For beginners, Apple Fitness both offers beginner routines, but Apple Fitness Plus makes it somewhat easier to get started with a choice of numerous classes dedicated to inexperienced users right on the opening dashboard. The Peloton lineup might feel daunting at first for a newbie who's not sure where to begin. Workout variety. The advantage here is Peloton. Apple is adding new classes regularly, but Peloton still has more variety, including more audio-only instruction for outdoor workouts, more types of yoga, and more options for strength training. And for community, the advantage once again is Peloton. For users who like exercising with other people, something sorely missing when you're doing reps in your living room, Peloton has live classes where you can see who's there with you and even send them a high five. Apple Fitness doesn't. Now, how about a message from the president and CEO of Consumer Reports, adapting to the changes? There are things we did before the pandemic that we would never do the same way again, including shopping. We've seen an acceleration in online purchasing that doesn't look to be slowing, and many walk-in stores are evolving to do more delivery or curbside pickups as consumer routines change. For a brief moment this past summer, with vaccinations on the rise, it seemed like casual browsing in stores might be a welcome change. But the Delta variant has reminded us that we aren't out of the woods yet. We've also witnessed some economic fallout in the marketplace, as the labor and supply chain disruptions of the past 18 months have led to shortages of goods ranging from dishwashers to used cars. We tend to think of online options as limitless, but a recent nationally representative CR survey found that almost all Americans, 90%, have felt some sort of economic impact when shopping for goods or services in the previous 3 months, including higher than expected prices, 68%, shortages, 60%, and delays, 58%, for products. We don't know how long the pandemic or economic consequences will continue, but we will be here to make sure you have the tools to shop smartly and safely in person and online. One great example is this month's cover story on how to navigate the altered marketplace. And look for CR recommended logo wherever you shop. Sign up for the latest CR.org newsletters and check out adfreecr.org when you need independent, trusted guidance. Cleaning up fast food. Despite modest improvements from Applebee's, IHOP, and Wendy's, and top marks for Chipotle and Panera, most national fast food eaters receive failing grades on the latest chain reaction report. A project by CR and five partners organizations tracking antibiotic use in the raising of beef by used by restaurant chains. The routine overuse of antibiotics in animals raised for food has enabled the evolution of bacteria that are largely impervious to the drugs. And the chains below have listings. Chipotle gets an A with the beef scorecard. Panera gets an A-. Wendy's, McDonald's, and Subway get C's. Taco Bell, Applebee's, and IHOP get D's. And the following get F's. Burger King, Panda Express, Starbucks, DQ, Domino's, Jack in the Box, Sonic, Pizza Hut, Olive Garden, and Little Caesars. CR's call to action. It has become increasingly clear that broadband service is not a luxury but a necessity, yet it remains inaccessible to too many Americans. You can help change that participating in Consumer Reports' Let's Broadband Together initiative, in which consumers nationwide are testing their Internet speeds and sharing copies of their Internet bills. The information will shed light on the industry practices and help us make high-speed Internet service accessible to everyone. More than 30,000 consumers have joined the effort already. But to win the fight for fair Internet, we need to hear more from you. Please go to broadbandtogether.org to help. More data for safety for safer roads. What's at stake? Many new cars come with active driving assistance systems, which combine speed control and automatic steering, intended to support drivers by relieving fatigue and stress on long trips or in stop-and-go traffic. These systems don't make the car self-driving, but they can sometimes increase the risk of driver inattention, so the government needs to ensure that they develop and rolled out safely. How CR has your back. To do that, CR has long argued regulators need more robust crash data, especially for instance involving technologies that automate part of the task of driving. After a string of high-profile car crashes involving systems such as Tesla's autopilot, progress is finally being made. In June, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration ordered companies to report all serious crashes that happened during or after use of a driving automation system. This order applies to all cars that can automate driving functions such as steering, acceleration, and braking. Though no truly self-driving cars are yet being sold to consumers, the order applies to those now being used for testing, ride-hailing, and delivery. The move is encouraging. With the new data, NHTSA can more readily track safety trends, identify risk, and develop smart, strong performance standards. What you can do, sign CR's petition telling automakers to make proven safety features standard on all vehicles. You can do it at CR.org, Auto Safety 1021. By the way, in case you haven't figured out yet, we're kind of overlapping months here because we kind of fell in the crease between 2 months. So we're starting a new Consumer Digest today, Consumer Reports today, although I have a report from another one which I'll read later. Our August cover story, Better Internet for Less Money, shared smart fixes for common broadband problems, as well as to lower your rates and increase your plan speeds. Readers wrote in with their Wi-Fi woes and solutions. I enjoyed your August 2021 report on Wi-Fi problems. After doing some of the checks mentioned in the article, I found that my issue was with my laptop's Wi-Fi card. My desktop computer was getting 225 Mbps via Wi-Fi, while the laptop in the same room was getting 25 Mbps. Xfinity-Comcast prices are high in the stores, and even over the phone. Signing up on the Internet as a new customer is the cheapest, so every 2 years when our guaranteed rate contract expires, my wife and I switch accounts. If the account is in my name, I cancel, then she signs up as a new customer. We have our own modem and router, so there's no equipment to turn in. Our current $59.99 a month for internet expires soon, so we'll play the game until Xfinity starts giving existing customers better deals. Your internet insights were thorough and educational. I wanted more insight into 5G home hotspots. I've used a Verizon G hotspot during the cable outages for email, but now with 5G speeds greater than cable, I see a future of no cable or satellite required and no wiring. How say your experts? Editor's note. There are a number of options that may eventually replace wired internet connections to the home. These include 5G, as you noted, fixed wireless, which uses broadcast towers to transmit the signal, and low-Earth satellite internet from companies such as Starlink from SpaceX. We'll continue to keep tabs on these options as they develop. One of the major problems with internet access is what works out as a de facto monopoly in most markets for most ISPs. We live in the capital city of a northeastern state that is close to a number of colleges, including two engineering schools and several research facilities. Despite all of that infrastructure and all of that need for internet access, there is one and only one carrier for our area, Spectrum. The service that we get is fine, for the most part. It is not exorbitantly expensive, as far as I can tell. I have tried to get service with other providers or even a quote, and all of them have provided the same answers that do not service in our area. The real solution to affordable broadband in the home is to make it a utility administered by local governments. While some states prohibit that by law, many other states allow it, and it can encourage competition. The city of Ammon, Idaho, provides the infrastructure for multiple providers to offer internet services, dramatically lowering cost. Ammon offers symmetrical 1 gigabyte per second fiber to the home for about $49.50 per month. Pay the actual cost to bring it to your home up front, which varies a couple of $1,000s, and the cost can be $23 per month or less. CR should back this initiative and encourage your members to promote and support them locally. Learn more at menunetworks.org. CR supports the idea of municipal broadband services in which a town or city offers its own internet plans to residents, sometimes in partnership with a private company. These city-run services may provide fast connections in neighborhoods where none are available from other ISPs. You're also correct. This policy can also introduce competition, as well as lower prices and margins that currently lack it. Regarding how to test your speed, the statement, first run a test with a computer that's physically plugged into your router using an Ethernet cord, is correct. But a better way is to run a test with a computer that is physically plugged into your modem to eliminate the router as a factor. Run the test before you have a problem and record it so that you have a baseline on what the speeds are supposed to be. You're correct. If you have a separate modem and router, plugging your computer directly into the modem can be a good way to test your speed. Many people, however, have a modem router, which is one device that handles both functions. Broken appliance. Fix it or ditch it. August 2021. You state, but dishwashers that cost $500 and under can get your dishes just as clean. It'd be nice if you covered those lower price models in your ratings. Not everyone wants or needs a high-end top-performance models. Editor's note. We know that finding high-performing yet affordable appliance can be difficult. That's why in our monthly What We're Testing sections, we often highlight affordable product picks to help consumers find a great model that fits their budget. This year's roundup includes a $500 energy-efficient dishwasher made by Whirlpool. Your flowchart about appliances not working didn't address whether the item you are considering replacing is easy recyclable or whether it contains chemicals or compounds that are bad for the environment. Some items are fairly easy to recycle. Often this is not the case with electronics, and if an item's price is such that it can easily be replaced and the energy use of the item isn't high, repairing might be the thing to do. Editor's note. You make an important point. As consumers, we need to be increasingly mindful of what products are made out of and where they end up. We're looking into research and the chemicals and compounds you mentioned, and this month CR's expert took a close look at the life cycle of a plastic product and what you can do to limit their harm, and we'll look at that later on. Car safety. In your trip on rollaway prevention, what's next in car safety? I worry about built-in car technology that cannot be easily disabled. The idea that a car should automatically shift into park when the engine is turned off sounds good until your car breaks down in the middle of the road and you have to push it to get it out of traffic. How do you do that when it is locked in park? Editor's note. Most cars that automatically shift into park when the engine is shut off can easily be shifted into neutral for the type of situation you describe. I lived in the Netherlands for a decade, so I was interested in your article regarding the danger to cyclists to Doring. Years ago, the Dutch came up with a low-tech solution that is actively promoted through driver education. It's called Reach Right. Drivers are taught to use their right hand to reach for the door handle. Doing so forces the driver to look over their shoulder and to more likely spot an oncoming cyclist. Simple and effective. In your August issue, one quick safety fix concerns me as vehicles that have lighted dashes. Anytime the car is running but don't have automatic headlights. Just about every night I see a modern vehicle with dash lights beaming bright, but with only daytime running lights on and no outside lights on at all. A sensibly regulation could remedy that. Editor's note. Additional light from the cabin or from well-lit roads can give drivers a false sense that headlights are on. While automatic headlights, those that turn on in low-light conditions, are increasingly common, they are not required in the U.S. and aren't a solution if the auto mode isn't selected. Canada has introduced a regulation requiring all new vehicles to have one of the following. Taillights that come on automatically with daytime running lights, headlights, taillights, and side marker lights that turn on automatically in the dark, or a dashboard that stays dark if headlights are not turned on. And join the Consumer Reports Board. Consumer Reports is seeking dynamic, dedicated candidates with the desire to advance our mission and improve the lives of consumers by serving on our board of directors. Ideal candidates will bring creativity, diversity of background and thought, experience in leadership, and a passion for empowering consumers and working to create a fair and just marketplace for all. Applications should be committed online at cr.org board application by November 30, 2021. A committee of board will review the applicants, conduct interviews, and recommend a slate to stand for election to a three-year term, board service beginning in October 2022. Board members are required to attend 3 meetings per year and participate in board business by video conference and email on an ongoing basis. No compensation is provided, but travel expenses are covered. And with that, we have time for one or two jokes. Name-dropping more like name-breaking. I've been moaning to a friend how my last name, Lawyer, is frequently changed to Lawyer by spell check. I can top that, he said. He's an anesthesiologist named Bause, B-A-U-S-E. But, he said, spell checking insists on calling me Dr. Abuse. Though my last name is not long, it can be confusing. So when a receptionist asks for it, I try simplifying matters by saying, it's the 4 letters of suggest. She smiled, and how do you spell that? And with that, we've run out of time for today's episode of Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long until next week, and thanks so much for listening.